Fed up with awkward customer conversations over who is responsible for damaged equipment? What if there was a way to prove this without a debate? With Record 360, you get time-stamped, geo-tagged photo and video proof. For total protection and complete peace of mind, visit record360.com/UK to learn more.
Wednesday, the 15th of April, 2026, and welcome to a very special episode of Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. And why is it a special episode, Phil?
It is. It is our 200th episode, David.
It is. Not just our 200th episode, but also...
It's going to be our last, certainly the last that you and I do.
Yeah.
Whether it gets reincarnated in the future, I don't know. But for Reconstruction with Bishop and Taylor, it's 200 and out.
Yes, absolutely. It's been 6 years, almost exactly 6 years.
No, more than 6 years. It's January we started.
Yes, January 2020 we started, yeah. Well, we've enjoyed it. I don't know if any of our listeners, well, I know that one or two of our listeners have, because they've been very kind enough to actually give some feedback and say that they liked it. So... yeah, end of an era. But, you know, we've still got a job to do, Phil. So I suppose we ought to pay lip service to the most recent news stories coming out of the construction industry. What's caught your attention?
Yeah, a couple of big stories in the past couple of weeks, which I think are worth a passing mention. I mean, as you say, it is what we do on this podcast is we talk about, the point of it is to talk about the news events of the UK construction industry. We'll do a little bit of self-indulgent talking about ourselves and looking back on the past 6 years of reconstruction and between us 80 years of construction journalism. But let's start off on script as we're supposed to. And I think the first one, which is very interesting, is Vistry Group. We mentioned, I believe, in a recent episode that Greg Fitzgerald... he announced his retirement. I don't know if he announced retirement or the company announced his retirement. On the 4th of March, 7 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago or something, Vistry announced that Greg Fitzgerald was stepping down from his job as both chairman and chief executive. He would step down as chairman on 13th of May, but he would continue as chief executive for up to a year, as long as it took to find a suitable replacement. And then, blow me, 13th of April... this week, just over a month later, they say, okay, what we told you before, we've accelerated things. He's no longer our chairman and he's no longer CEO. He's gone as CEO. And in his place, we've appointed some guy born in the 1990s. just turned 35. Yeah. Adam Daniels, just turned 35. He's been running the company's regional offices, Yorkshire, Midlands and West of England office for the past 3 years. I mean, it's clearly a rapid high flyer. Joined Countryside Partnerships in 2016. So he's been there 10 years. He's been there, you know, but to join them at 24, 25-year-old Countryside Partnership. Mm. He's still in his 20s and took on his first leadership role. Vistry took over Countryside Partnerships in 2022. And he's obviously highly regarded in the company. Mm. And he's got the top job. Now... Vistry's statement of this week, it said, the appointment follows the conclusion of a thorough multi-year CEO succession and development process led by the nomination committee. Now, thorough multi-year process?
Probably started when Daniels was in his teens.
Yeah. And that all seems a bit odd. And I was interested to read the Times reporting on this. It's sort of saying that the city analysts and shareholders have been taken by surprise. And they're all a bit, construction industry analyst was quoted by the Times as saying, it appears a little rushed. Well, if they'd asked me, I would have said exactly the same thing. It appears a little rushed. It reminds me of earlier this year, back end of last year, Marshalls, the brick and block paving company, end of last year, they got rid of their CEO and put in an interim person and said, we're going to send out the headhunters far and wide. We're going to do a proper search to find the best person for the job. And then within very, very short order. And given this, there being Christmas over the interval, in the interim period, it was only early January when he said, actually, you know what we told you last, you know, a few weeks ago? The guy we picked as interim is now going to have it full time. And you think, well, why didn't you say that in the first place? You can't really have done a proper search unless there was only one person that you wanted and you made one phone call and they said, no, thanks. And then you said, oh, they don't want it. We'll go for our second choice. That could be it. But if this 35-year-old has been identified as the next CEO after a multi-year succession and development process, you'd thought, well, why don't you just announce that on the 4th of March? But the other thing is, it seems a huge step change from Greg Fitzgerald. You know, it was Mr. Vistry. It's all intents and purposes of it. It was his sandpit. It seemed like he was chairman and chief executive, which goes against city codes and, you know, received best practices of how to run publicly quoted companies. He was the architect of the move from being a speculative developer to what they call partnerships, i.e. basically a contractor for housing associations. And that hadn't worked out very well. And then, as we've talked about before, they had this big hole in their accounts last year when they underestimated costs in a couple
of
regions.
One of their divisions, wasn't it?
Not divisions run by the Tyro Adam Daniels, it should be, which presumably is a big feather in his cap that other people were screwing up all around him, and he obviously has come out clean. But it does. I can't help thinking that one would imagine that they control that board.
Yes,
they've got all the cards.
Yeah.
Now, whether Greg Fitzgerald genuinely has just said, "Yeah, I've had enough. I'm out." He may be. Personal issues at play here that we have not been privy to, and why should we? So I wouldn't want to speculate about that. But for whatever reason, he's out. And maybe the appointment of a 35-year-old is the board saying, with this bright young thing in charge, we might be able to, you know, mould him in our shape. We might be able to control him. He's unlikely to come in axes swinging and guns blazing and telling us what to do left, right and centre. We may be able to have a more collegiate board process. I have no idea the personnel on that board. I don't know how the board functions, but it just strikes me that that might be the one of the big appeal of a 35-year-old, someone born in the 1990s, over someone who, frankly, in the best possible way, is a dinosaur.
Well, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. I mean, obviously, they wouldn't have chosen this chap, Daniels, unless he had displayed, exceptional leadership skills. I mean, clearly, he's got a long way to go if he's only in his mid-30s and he's already got to the top of this organisation. But as you say, because he's got a long way to go, he's still developing in many ways. He's clearly demonstrated his capabilities. But perhaps he hasn't got the arrogance or the self-confidence of somebody twice his age, or, well, no, Greg Fitzgerald wasn't twice his age, but, you know, several decades older, who, has the force of personality to perhaps steamroller his way through and basically dictate what happens. I mean, this chap, Daniels, presumably is perhaps more deferential to the board. Maybe he thinks, because they've been here longer than me, I need to give them a fair hearing and take their advice. So I could see that it would make sense if they wanted to, I don't know, steady the ship, as it were, to put somebody like that in charge.
I wonder whether he is, in any sense, a Fitzgerald protege, and he will keep phone lines open to Greg Fitzgerald.
Oh, I don't know.
I think if I was in that, if I was 35 and taking over a job like that, I'd want a mentor to someone to quietly go talk to and chew the fat with.
Yeah, it's a possibility, I suppose. But again, it's only our speculation. We don't know what relationships are like in that organisation. But no, it is definitely a very interesting appointment. I mean, you don't often get 35-year-olds being appointed to the top job in a major construction firm or house building firm, as it is here.
Well, it's a bit of a contrast with, it's only a month or two ago that Barrett Redrow the only building, the house builder that's bigger than Vistry, I believe. Is that right? Are Vistry number two and Barratt number one? Anyway, they're...
I think, yeah, people say Vistry are, but I don't think my latest analysis shows that they are. I think it was still Taylor Wimpey.
But Barratt Redrow also have had, just in the recent weeks, a change announced the change of leadership. Yeah, David Thomas, after 17 years with the company, 11 as chief executive, he's retiring later this year. And a guy called Dean Banks, who was previously chief executive of Balfour Beatty UK Construction Services, is going to come in and take over, who is someone with larger, you know, bigger stuff on his, well, because he's older, but, you know, more experience, and he's more kind of thing. Yeah, that's the sort of person you can imagine a big company wanting to bring in as chief executive. Having said that, I love, I always think it's a good sign of a company when they do promote from within. I think if you haven't got an internal appointee, you're doing something wrong. And I've used the analogy before of, Bill Shankly, comparing Bill Shankly to Alex Ferguson, and everything. You know, Alex Ferguson, the most successful football manager in the English football history, probably. And yet, when he went, everything went pear-shaped. Whereas when Shankly went, they carried on winning with a succession of winning managers, each handing over with a culture that passed on.
Yeah.
So that's why I've argued on this podcast in the past that Shankly is better than Ferguson for that very reason. And I think similarly, a company that brings its chief executives on, and other, you know, and other senior executives, brings them on from within, that's a well-run company.
If
when the, you know, the chief goes, it's like, yikes, now what do we do? then I wouldn't buy shares in that company.
No, certainly if people aren't up to snuff and they can't step into the top job. No, I agree. I think it's only logical that you plan for succession and, you know, you bring on people from within. And as you say, there's a sort of a continuity in terms of culture as well. I mean, it's all very well to bring in, if a company is failing and there's something wrong with it, wrong with the culture, wrong with the way it's being run, then yes, you
helicopter slash somebody and burn into, needed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but no, if it's a well-run company, then surely you'll have people further down who are coming up through the ranks and will be able to do the job. Well, we've got another topic to discuss before we start our self-indulgent reminiscences. Another interesting, a conclusion to a long-running story, actually. You've written quite a lot in the last year or so about Van El, which is probably the biggest specialist piling contractor in the UK. Van El, I think the first story which hit the headlines last year was when Van El, had gone into Canada, they'd set up a Canadian subsidiary, they'd ventured across the Atlantic. I think it was the first time they'd done anything outside the UK. They'd gone into Canada basically on the strength of a major, I think it was a metro project which was coming up in one of the big cities out there, I can't remember which one. And that project was scaled back, and Van El rather reluctantly, but necessarily, decided that it wasn't going to be able to make it in Canada after all, because obviously work wasn't there. So they pulled out of Canada, which was a bit of a shame for them. But they've had a few issues, haven't they, over the years? And they seem to have been building up recently. They issued a profit warning
read out the headlines.
Okay.
From the Construction Index. From Van El over the past 2 years, starting January 2024. Slowdown softens Van El's interims. Mm-hmm. Van El holds margins despite dip in revenue. Van El frustrated by project delays. Van El sounds profit warning. Van El makes Canada U-turn. Van El issues another profit warning. Mm-hmm. Van El sells Canada subsidiary. Van El profits soften, but it sees signs of recovery. And in amongst all of that, just to add insult to injury, Van El fined £233,000 after piling rig fatality. So it's not been a happy time for them in general. And yet the news this this week, last week, is that they've accepted, or it's not so much they've accepted, they've gone seeking a white knight to buy them, and they've agreed a deal with Strabag, the Austrian construction contractor, who are paying just shy of £60 million to buy Van El. Not only has Van El been slightly struggling lately, in the documentation they put out explaining why they're doing it, they say Van El's been on the alternative investment market of the stock exchange since 2016, publicly listed, and saying the level of cost and resource required to maintain Van El's stock market listing is excessive for the size of the group and detrimental to its performance and focus. Now, that's quite interesting, and that's got wide implications. And they say that they think the share price is unlikely to reflect the fundamental value of the business, given the illiquid trading in its shares and investor sentiment towards smaller UK-quoted companies remaining subdued. In other words, they think 10 years ago, the idea was, if we go onto the stock exchange listing, it'll be great. We can fund our growth, and they did do some growth. They bought Rock and Alluvium, the Gallagher tri-piling division, and they did some expansion, bought new kit. But when the market went a bit south and things got a bit difficult, suddenly they don't like it. So they think they'd be a lot better under Strabag ownership. What I thought also was very interesting, they also said in their documentation, the Van El board, in conjunction with its advisors, considered a wide range of factors when appraising the proposal from Strabag, including, and it gives three reasons. The first one they list is the opportunity for shareholders, and these include the management. The managers of Van El, a company of this size, they own a bunch of stock in the company. And the board, other non-execs. But the opportunity for shareholders to realise, I'll quote it directly, the opportunity for Van El shareholders to realise in cash their entire shareholding in full at an attractive value, which the Van El board believes delivers the value of its standalone growth strategy on an accelerated basis. I'll translate that to English. We want our money.
Yes.
So, number one, the first thing they're thinking of is, we want our money. That, you know, we've got shares tied up in this business, and we'd like to cash out, please. We want our money back. Now, I'm not sure that I would put that third. If I was doing their PR, I would say number one is what's good for the future of the company and its employees. Because don't all companies say our employees are our most important people, not our shareholders? Of course the shareholders are most important. Of course that's what drives you. But you don't say that out loud.
Nobody says that.
Apart from Van El. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Well, you know, probably do the same if I were in their position, wouldn't you?
Yes, but I wouldn't phrase it.
No,
like
you wouldn't
that.
Say it. You wouldn't.
I'd say this is for the future of the company.
Yeah.
It's like all those people who do employee ownership things. They come out looking like St. Francis of Assisi. I'm going to hand my business over to my employees because I'm retiring. The best thing for the business. These employees have been great, and I'm going to reward them by giving them
the company.
And you often hear it put in those terms. I'm giving them the company. No, you're not. You're dumping a whole load of debt. You're taking your money, your cash out, and leaving them to struggle on without the people that started it, which is why very often, disproportionately often, I wouldn't say very often, but disproportionately often, companies that are sold to employee ownership trusts go out of business within a year or two.
I thought you were a champion of EOTs. I thought you were all in favour.
I used to be. I liked the idea of it. I was. When it works, and when the people who are cashing out are not too aggressive in their cashing out. I do like the idea, you know, Marks and Spencer's and all of that, lovely. But sometimes it can be a bit Maxwellian.
Yeah. Well, that's quite damning, actually, Maxwellian. Well, I know what you mean.
I don't think it's quite as all sweetness and light and roses.
No,
as it is always presented is all I'm saying.
It's like all these things. It's it depends on circumstances and how it's handled. I mean, certainly some some businesses, I'm sure, have thrived after it's been after ownership has been transferred to the workers. And you know, there's the advantage of everybody has a, you know, has a dog in the fight, as it were, and everybody, you know, unifies the business, and all the employees feel like this is, you know, this is mine. You know, I'm not just working for the man; I'm working for myself. And I'm sure that that pays off in certain circumstances. But yeah, sometimes if basically you're letting the you're running the business down and you want to get out, it might be a poison chalice to hand it over to your employees.
Anyway, the reason why we got onto that was the idea that normally when you sell a company, your spin doctors will say, number one, we're doing it for the people. We're doing, yeah. You know, we're doing it for the employees, the team, and the future of the company. And number one reason for that, Van El, is we're doing it because the shareholders want their bloody money back.
Yeah. Oh, well, I admire their candour.
That's all I have to say on that one. And that's
well, me too.
And for reasons I'll explain, I don't really have any eye on the news because I am no longer doing the daily online news service of the Construction Index. As of before Easter, folks, I'm retired, and this is my this podcast is my last engagement as a construction journalist, which I've been doing for almost as long as you.
Yes.
But which is why this podcast is over and out from us.
Yes, indeed.
You're carrying on for a bit, I think, David.
Well, I'm carrying on for a little bit.
You do the magazine. If any listeners who don't understand, I do...
Yeah, the magazine will... I'm producing another issue of the magazine next month. And then we've got a bit of a hiatus. And then I'm doing a September issue, which will contain our usual top 100 survey. But then after that, I'm out as well. And handing over to a successor. And the successor on the magazine will be the same successor on the daily online news. He'll be a busy man.
Yes, we lambasted before companies are unable to promote from within. Yeah. But we're such a small, lean team. There is only you and I on the editorial side of the Construction Index. So we had to get the headhunters out and find the best person for the job.
Yeah.
And the man we found was, purely coincidentally, yet another person who's had the same pedigree in journalism as you and I, another former editor of Cranes Today.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, I still get ribbed about Cranes Today. Why wasn't it ever on Have I Got News For You and all the rest of it?
It was. When was I was in my time there, it was on.
Oh, was it? But yeah, Will North is the name of our successor. He edited Cranes Today a long time after I left and sometime after you left as well, I believe.
A good while after, a decade or more after I left. But he's, more recently, he might be known to listeners for the Engineering Matters podcast. I think there must be some overlap between Reconstruction and Engineering Matters.
Yeah.
So if you listen to Engineering Matters, you will be familiar with the work of Will North. And he has already taken over from me doing the daily online news service. And, yeah, as you say, we'll be doing the magazine as well,
because
being significantly younger than you and I, he's got far more energy to be able to do both jobs.
But as you say, you know, the pedigree is impeccable. And so in a way, I suppose there's definitely a succession there, although with a few interruptions. So you mentioned that we have nearly, I think it's not quite 80 years of construction journalism between us. When did you start?
I joined New Civil Engineer magazine in 1987 when it was in the boom times for civil engineering. It was rolling in cash. It was owned by the Institution of Civil Engineers. And I can't remember exactly what the structure was, but Thomas Telford Publishing, the publishing arm of the institution, the ICE, had to give back, I think, a percentage of its profits. So it was trying... The managers of Thomas Telford were trying not to make too much profit so that they didn't have to, you know, raise expectations and make a rod for their own back. So they didn't funnel too much back to the institution. With that in mind, they're investing heavily in the magazine. They're staffing up. It was taxis everywhere, first class travel.
Oh, yeah.
My first expenses sheet was handed back to me because I clearly hadn't been doing my job properly because I hadn't taken anyone out to lunch that month. And it was different days. You were expected to wine and dine people, and you had to learn that, which for, would I have been 23, 24 years old, was quite quite intimidating. I hadn't eaten anything more than a greasy spoon restaurant. But taking captains of industry out for lunch and dinner was almost the hardest part of the job.
It doesn't happen.
Don't get that
anymore. I don't think it happens. I mean, my first job was with Cranes Today, actually, as a editorial assistant. 1986. That was in 1986.
40 years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm 39 years was, and you're 40 years.
Yeah. And I joined as editorial assistant. And then the assistant editor left. And then a year later, the editor left. And I can't remember. United Trade Press was the publisher. And they did believe in recruiting from within the organization. So a year after joining the magazine as an editorial assistant, I was the editor, and I had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely none at all.
Plus ça change, eh?
Yeah, plus. Well, I'm getting used to it.
I take that back. You are an utter expert in the arts.
No. But I did, I mean, I can remember, yeah, the wining and dining and all that sort of stuff, that took a bit of getting used to. My first overseas trip was to Bologna.
Saifa?
No. Yes, it was Saifa. Yes, you're absolutely right. We were taken to a very nice restaurant by our hosts, and I can't remember who they were. And I had gone completely unprepared. I mean, I just had casual clothes. I did have a tie, but we were in this rather snooty Italian restaurant, and I didn't have a jacket. And they insisted that I wear a jacket, and they found me one, which was far too big. So I didn't know what I was doing, had no idea at all. But that was a strange. It was an exciting time, you know. Still quite young, and hadn't done anything like that before. I'd had periods of unemployment, and then I'd worked on some government sort of job creation scheme up in Stoke-on-Trent, and then I found myself working for what's now BAE Systems, and then from there it was straight into Cranes Today and completely unfamiliar territory. So yes, it took a while to get used to it. It was a steep learning curve.
And I first encountered you because I'd never heard of Cranes Today when you were there, when I was at New Civil Engineering.
Of course.
But when did you join Construction News then?
I was at Cranes Today for about 4 years, and then I joined. I cannot remember them. It doesn't really matter what the publisher's name was, but it was a construction news group. And I launched a magazine which lasted about a year called Plant Hire Review. We had some very stiff competition. It was a monthly magazine about plant hire. And
up against PMJ, Plant Manager's Journal. Wasn't it?
Yeah, and there was another one as well. And I couldn't compete. And anyway, it didn't. I couldn't compete, and neither could our advertising sales team. So that folded. And then I moved sideways to Construction News, first as supplements editor and eventually as features editor. And that's the role I had when I finally left. In 1998, I think I left. Yes, must have been. It doesn't seem that long ago, but that's an awfully long time ago when you think about it.
And I know what you mean. It does. I mean, these days, you think about, for many years, it was like, oh, was it, 21st century or 20th century for many years? You thought like that. That was it. Now, was it pre-COVID or post-COVID? Yeah, 2020 seems like.
Yes, ancient history.
In some ways, and in other ways, I occasionally bump into someone or get in touch with make contact with an old friend I haven't seen for a bit, and say, "When did we last see each other?" Says, "Well, it's before COVID." Oh my God, we've gone 6-7 years without contact. Pauline.
Yeah, I know.
It's sort of a marker point in how we think of what's been going on.
What do you think has been the biggest change in our little area of journalism since since you joined? What's been the biggest shift?
It's got to be the technology. When I was like you, when I was editor of Cranes Today, there was a lot of, because it's an international magazine, a lot of foreign travel, going to trade shows around the world and visiting big companies and manufacturers. And I'd spend 2 weeks a month on the road or overseas, and then I'd have 2 weeks to write up the magazine. I didn't have a freelance budget, I didn't have any staff. I'd have to write the whole magazine in 2 weeks and proof it, sub it, etc. No, didn't even have a sub editor or anything like that. And I didn't have a laptop, I didn't have a mobile phone. So there's nothing, yeah, you just had your notepad. You came home with your notepad and rolls of film. I had to walk down to Boots in the lunch hour to get my film developed. There wasn't, no dark. New Civil Engineer had two staff photographers and a dark room. It's, different setup completely. But the fact that firstly the internet, and then there's the whole mobile communication. And I feel like quite glad that I'm getting out before AI takes over completely, because I have no idea how it works or what it does. And I was very happy to read this morning that Rachel Reeves is equally clueless. She made a big speech, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made a big speech recently saying the future of this country rests in AI, it's going to save the economy, it's going to be fantastic. and Mumsnet users said, what AI do you use? And he said, I don't use AI, I wouldn't know how to. It's a bit of a kind of oops moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm with her. I don't use AI, I wouldn't know how to.
I mean, it is, certainly online has been the biggest thing. I mean, in every walk of life, really. But I mean, the death of print, I think, is one of the most... I mean, I'm a print journalist. I've always been a print journalist, and I've failed to move with the times. But, back in the day, when I joined Construction News, it was... A3, was it? I don't know. It was a tabloid. It was a tabloid-sized newspaper, basically. And it was always in print. And as you say, the production process... taking me back to my days at Cranes Today, absolutely. I remember travelling for half the time and then scrabbling and working weekends to actually write the bloody thing up in the two remaining weeks. And now you type out your copy in a Word document, you email it to production with the pictures, which you also email to production, you get a page proof back. But back in the... when I started, you typed it on a typewriter, and you kept what they call blacks, which is used carbon paper to get a copy. You kept your blacks. You sent off, you marked up and sent off the typescript to the printer. They printed out what were known as galley proofs, and they came back just one long ribbon of printed text. And then that went to your design studio next door, and they used rubber solution glue to physically paste these ribbons of text onto a grid page, and then mark up the pictures. The pictures had to go to somebody else to be turned into blocks or scans. And if they were colour ones, you'd get them back with sort of three sheets of transparency. And all that production, backwards and forwards, that's just all gone. And it went overnight.
Well, the one I particularly... remember benefiting from, because I never benefited particularly from, I went freelance. I didn't have actually my own laptop and mobile phone till I went freelance in 2004. But I do remember probably around late 90s, turn of the century, one year you go to trade shows and you would be picking up all the product literature and press material that all the companies were putting out. And I'd be wheeling a suitcase or a trolley on wheels or something, because there'd be vast amounts of paper that you'd just grab everything and then get back to your hotel of an evening and think, right, what do I need here? And you'd chuck half of it away or three quarters of it away, but you'd still, even after you'd whittled it all down after 3 or 4 days trudging around Bauma or something, you'd have swathes of material.
Yeah.
Which is super, really heavy and a real drag. And then, within 2 years, they were giving you either a CD or more likely a...
memory stick.
Memory stick. Yes. And this is the time when memory sticks first appeared, and they're really handy. And, you know, they probably cost about, you know, 1 meg stick would be about 10 quid or something.
Yeah.
And then rapidly, you're getting a 1 tera. I mean, the first time I got a press back on a 1 tera memory stick, I thought, this is really useful having this. I'll take that, whether I care about what's on it or not.
You know,
take it off and use it for your, you know, whatever, personal use. But it just became so much easier to pocket all the memory sticks rather than tons of paper. So the technology has been, I think, undoubtedly, it's made the job so much easier in so many ways.
Yeah. What was your favourite assignment, Phil, the best assignment of all? Or what news story are you most proud of breaking?
I'm not sure I can think of breaking stories. I think the report that I'm proud of, simply because by the contacts I had, I managed to get access. In September 2001, it's about 17 days after two planes had crashed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. And I think I've spoken about this on the podcast before a few years ago. I happened to be at a conference in, Wyoming or somewhere miles away from New York, but I was on that side of the Atlantic. And I saw someone at this conference, and they said, Jimmy Lomas should be here, but he's on site at Ground Zero. He's like holding the fort there. And I thought, I should be there. Mm. When I was on a weekly news magazine, New Civil Engineer, we'd gone straight out there. Any big story, you get on the plane, you go there. Earthquakes, bridge collapses, whatever. And I managed to get hold of Jimmy on the phone, who is the owner, boss of New York Crane. And I said, I want to come and see what you're doing. And he went, all right. He wasn't supposed to, but he got me on site on the pretext of, because I was foreign, I was European, therefore I was a Liebherr consultant. It was my cover. No one asked and no one cared, because I was with him and no one, you know, questions it. This is a guy who lived really close to the site, just the other side of one of the tunnels. And he was on site within hours. And even, he was living in a camper van on site, and hadn't been home for weeks. And even though this was 17 days after the towers had come down, it was still, as you can imagine, carnage on site. We've all seen the photos, we've all seen the pictures. But to get up close and to talk to the people, the riggers and the crane guys who are doing all the heavy machinery, the movement of you know, pulling away all the ironwork, watching the assembly in this very constrained, compact disaster zone, 900-ton rated Manitowoc, was it 21,000 or something, one of the big Manitowoc cranes being assembled together. And I was clicking away with a not particularly good camera. And because my camera was not particularly good, it almost meant the photos were better for it, because it had more sort of rusty realism to it rather than shiny polish. And that was...
Big story.
It was a big story. It had been some years since I'd done anything. I think the previous thing I'd done like that was more than a decade earlier. I reported on the disaster response to the Lockerbie plane crash, Pan Am Flight 103, just before Christmas. It came down 21st of December, and I spent 23rd, 24th up in Lockerbie with the local authority, municipal engineering team, about the disaster response, the practicality, the logistics of everything. And that, at the time, that was pretty harrowing. More so, I was in awe of the people who were there on day one, what they were doing, what they were seeing, what they were coping with, and how they were coping with it.
Yeah.
Similarly, at Ground Zero, a whole different scale. But equally, it's people who are used to working hard, used to heavy work, hard work, to putting a shift in, going above and beyond in deeply traumatic circumstances. And it wasn't the story, it was just seeing the worst that people can do had happened, and the best that people could do was the response. Yeah. And I've never been in the business of reporting on the worst that people can do. That's your Kate Ayers. But as a construction journalist, not just in disaster response, but building bridges, tunnels, mm-hmm. dams, big buildings, that's, you know, the best that people can do.
Yeah, yeah. No, I feel the same. I mean, I've often been in awe of the capabilities of some of the people I've met, particularly out on site. You meet some of these people out there and you look at the jobs they're doing. Take, for example, what's now the Elizabeth line. What was that called?
Crossrail.
Crossrail, that's the one. I mean, the engineering that went into a project like that is astonishing. And some of the people on site doing the most amazing work, and you just wonder how they do it. Obviously, it's a team effort. You know, you've got your engineers and your designers as well as your contractors and your subcontractors and all the suppliers and people like that. But the people controlling it on site and overseeing it, they're multitasking like there's no tomorrow. It's astonishing. So that sort of story I've always found really quite exciting. I mean, I think the most my favourite job was a job I gave myself, because it was back in the 90s. Do you remember the Roads to Prosperity or Roads for Prosperity? I can't remember. Was
Paul Shannon was the Transport Secretary, that's, of Public Said, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Big motorway widening programme.
Yeah, big, huge road building programme, which actually sort of fizzled out like things like this often do. But because there was going to be a massive demand for aggregate, Tarmac had was negotiating purchase of a mountain on the Isle of Harris up in the Hebrides. And they wanted to turn this mountain into a sea lock. They're going to extract, I think it was 50 million tons of granite or basalt or whatever it was. And it was a big story because there was a lot of opposition to it. But there was also, I discovered locally, quite a lot of people in favour of it, because it was going to bring jobs and prosperity to, you know, the outer Hebrides. So I decided to go up there, and I went up there for the best part of a week and interviewed as many people as I could find. The owner of the mountain, of course, who was absolutely cock-a-hoop. He wanted to pocket the money. A local Church of Scotland minister, headmistress of a school, a local GP, that was interesting. I looked at he showed me, had a card file, it wasn't electronic. He just showed me the thickness of the cards representing his patients. And the thickest by far were people in their 60s and above. And it was just, you know, it was a dying population. People were getting old. There weren't enough young people coming through. He was in favour of it. The owner of a hotel, who had moved up from London and opened a hotel, he wasn't in favour of it. And that was fascinating. That was really fascinating. Yeah.
Was so that Glen Sander? Is that Glen Sander? Or was that a different quarry?
No, that wasn't Glen Sander. It was the mountain, the settlement was called Rodell. Glen Sander already existed.
Right.
And I can't remember, that wasn't Tarmac, that was somebody else.
So when did Rodell happen then? It went ahead, did it?
No, it didn't. No, it didn't go ahead. No, it didn't go ahead. Not because the people against it won the argument, but because the road building programme didn't go ahead the way it was planned, and Tarmac didn't need all that aggregate after all. So Glen Sander, I'm not even sure Glen Sander's up in Scotland. But anyway, yeah, that was probably the most satisfying assignment I did. I wrote a couple of quite long features in Construction News on the back of that. But yeah, there's been some highlights. There's been lowlights as well. I remember once being taken up to Felixstowe on a really, really cold winter's day. Somebody, PR man representing a company that made electronics, was taking me up to see the thyristor controls on a ship-to-shore container crane. And it was immensely boring. He was late picking me up. I think I might have told this story before, but I went, climbed up this bloody crane, absolutely froze my socks off. He opened this cabinet and showed me lots of winking lights, and then we climbed down the crane again. It was a complete non-story. And I fell asleep in his car. He was supposed to be taking me back to North London where I was going to catch the tube home. And I fell asleep in his car. I was so cold, he turned the heating right up. And I fell asleep. When I woke up, we were coming into Cambridge. He said, I thought we'd go, I know a nice tea shop. I thought we'd go and get a cup of tea.
You've been kidnapped.
Yeah, I had been kidnapped. So that was one of the lowlights. Yeah. But yeah, that highlights, lowlights and everything else in between.
What about the Reconstruction podcast? This is our last episode, Dave. We've done 200. Any highlights, any favourite podcasts that we've done?
Well, it's been fun. It's always been nice just to sort of sit down and chew over the fat and talk about things that we've been reading over the past couple of weeks or past week originally, because it was weekly to begin with. Latterly, our guests have been picked by us. When somebody has done something or said something interesting and we want to quiz them about it a little bit more, or in the case of my favourite guest, who's Professor Rudy Klein, who we had on not long ago, actually.
He's been on somebody three times. He's the only person who's come on three times.
He's been on three times. Rudy is he's a great talker. He's a legal expert. He's a barrister, and he's been very, very central to efforts to get rid of what we used to call subby abuse, you know, retentions and late payments and stuff like that. He's been a central figure in that and highly respected in the industry. But he's also really, really good at discussing these things and putting the message across. So he's been my favourite guest, I should think. But we've had others. Another guest I really like, I think we've had her on twice. Was it twice? Jo Gilroy from Balfour Beatty.
Oh, she was superb, yes.
She was very good. I mean, we were talking about HVO, hydro-treated vegetable oil. We first invited her on when we learned that Balfour Beatty, along with one or two other organisations, including, I think, the Environment Agency, weren't as keen on HVO as a lot of other people were, which was strange because that was going against the grain of sort of public opinion. Basically, HVO was a substitute for diesel and it was good for the planet and all the rest of it. And she very eloquently pointed out that, you know, things aren't black and white necessarily. HVO has its role, but they'd identified a risk that the demand for HVO, outstripping the source, which is supposed to be used vegetable oil, was in danger of encouraging the deforestation of huge parts of Indonesia in order to plant palm oil, oil palms, and make HVO out of those.
Well, she didn't make this analogy, but it's just occurred to me that I think this analogy could be made with HVO is the opioids that when they were first dished out by doctors, the idea was that it would be, you know, better to have an opioid than to be, you know, have the condition that you had, and it was a good thing.
Chronic pain, yeah.
And yet the cure becomes almost worse than the disease ultimately. Yes. When you know the opioid
I don't know. It's certainly it's worse in America, isn't it?
Yeah, but the scandal of it, the rifeness of opioids, and I think there's a certain thing with HVO. You, at first glance, you think this is a good thing, and then what it might lead to down the line, unforeseen consequences.
Yes, exactly. I think that was the most interesting thing about the whole story. Actually, was a. It was a really good illustration that all these things, especially nowadays when, I mean, for a long time now, carbon reduction and that kind of thing has been really top of the agenda. And people have seized upon anything that's come out as a green box to tick, effectively. And you and I suppose, have always been slightly, I wouldn't say cynical, but sceptical about some of these things because so often people come along and say, oh, we need more. This isn't exactly what people have said, but wind turbines and solar panels and stuff like this. I mean, obviously there are benefits to these things and renewable energy is very important, but you've got to think it through. You've got to look at it holistically. And I mean, if you were to take wind turbines and solar panels, they have to be built. They have to be made. Where do you get the energy to make them? Where do you get the raw materials to make them? What's the carbon footprint of their production? What's their whole life?
Recyclability.
recyclability, all the rest of that. You've got to look at it, you know, in the round, and then try and decide for yourself what you think on balance, whether it's a benefit or not. And this is exactly what people like Balfour Beatty were doing with H4O. They were saying, yeah, it's great that we don't have to use fossil fuels to power our excavators and our dump trucks and our lorries. But let's look, before we, you know, go all guns blazing into H4O, let's look at what the long-term effects would be. And they just, you know, they weren't saying we're never going to use it. They just said, let's not use it until we're absolutely sure that it's sustainable, properly sustainable, and not just a bit of greenwashing. I don't know what their position is now, because, of course, HVO is still available and a lot of people still swear by it. But we haven't got a limitless quantity of used vegetable oil, you know, chip fat and stuff like that. And demand is going to outstrip supply.
I think it's... there are HVO stories yet to emerge. I think this is a, I think the opioid parallel may yet come home.
Mm. Yeah.
When you talk about unforeseen consequences, the biggest story, I think, possibly of my entire career from a news point of view, in terms of the consequence and fallout, was the Grenfell Tower fire of 2017, 9 years ago. There have been other fires which have killed lots of people. There have been other collapses and explosions which have led to design codes being changed and materials mixes being changed and so on and so forth. We've learnt a lot from mistakes in engineering. But what made the Grenfell Tower fire so different has been the regulatory impact. First of all, it exposed appalling corruption, frankly, or shoddiness, sins of omission or sins of commission, probably more so sins of omission by more parties, but some sins of commission,
willful ignorance in many cases.
But I've said before, I think the fault mostly lies at the people who were making and selling materials for applications for which they were not suitable, and the certification bodies who were giving out certificates like lollipops. And initially it was been, you know, the bloody builders. Mm-hmm. Clearly the builders were at fault, but I put them lower down the list, and I think it has become, you know, what I'm saying is it might have been controversial in 2017. It is not now. I think that's generally seen to be that they are down the chain of yes, they're culpable, but just a bit lower down. And that came out in the official inquiry report. But it's that the something must be done, natural response by people, by the industry, by governments, by politicians. Something must be done, and we must do as much as humanly possible. And when the inquiry report says we must have this, we must have the other, government says, yeah, we're going to take all of these on board. Fortunately, a couple of things it has pushed back on, like nationalising product testing. I mean, basically, it didn't use so many words, but the Grenfell inquiry report wanted the BRE to be reconstituted in public ownership, being the only person allowed to test and certify products, which would have just been a nonsense, as much of the nonsense. I mean, the impact of the whole... I've only been retired two weeks, Dave, and I can't remember what it's called. Building Regulation Authority, is that what it's called? The bit of the health and safety...
The official building regulator, the building regulator, isn't it?
Building regulator, anyway, the body where you have to get Gateway 123 approval from.
Yes.
I mean, everyone said, yeah, we need more regulation because this bad thing has happened. And it's a nonsense. I know the reform housing spokesperson lost his job for making this point in a particularly cack-handed manner, and he made his language was cack-handed, but the point he was trying to make, and it's the only time I've ever read anything by anyone from reform that I actually agree with, is that the regulatory, the knee-jerk of regulation has it's not just been a knee-jerk, it's been a stranglehold, and it's just gone too far. Mm. And we're not able to do what the country needs to do, which is build, because of the new regulatory regime. And more is to come. Apparently, there's still the push for builder's licence, whether it's going to be for cat-flap fitters that the FMB want, or whether it's going to be for skyscraper builders that the Grenfell report authors want. But no one's saying we should have licences for building nuclear submarine bases or hospitals. It's just like tall buildings or cat flaps. I mean, conservatories. So there's an awful lot of nonsense going on out there about regulatory reform that is needed or is coming down the line. And I'm glad I'm out of it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll continue to keep an eye on what's going on, looking from the sidelines.
The one thing I wanted to mention, I asked you what your favourite podcast was. You never asked me what my favourite episode was. And I just want to chuck out there. I particularly enjoyed it when we've been able to get away from the core topics of industry regulation, Grenfell, late payment reform, health and safety, and all these things which are the bread and butter of a construction journalist. And on the episode that we had, in episode 60, I found, April 2021, we had Dr. Benoit Jones from the British Tunnelling Society, who had commissioned some work to mark the 50th anniversary of the society, and the British Tunnelling Society had commissioned folk musician Nancy Kerr to write a song, and she ended up writing a whole EP. And we had Nancy Kerr. We had a folk singer on Reconstruction.
I completely forgot about that. Yeah, absolutely. We should have done more of that.
We should have. Well, I always wanted, every time we were stuck for something to talk about, I'd say, David, maybe this is the episode where we can talk about representations of the construction industry in literature, cinema, and the arts. Mm. And you go, but I only know Bob the Builder.
Yes.
And you go, oh, no, there's that Tom Hardy film. Is it Lock, I think? Which is a superb film and really, really interesting, good portrayal of construction. Or there's, The Fountainhead, that Ayn Rand's bizarre madcap story of an architect. And I always thought there was scope for us to go more down the arts and creative side of representation of construction, but you were never keen on that one.
No, maybe you should have pushed me a bit harder. To be honest, I mean, yeah, Bob the Builder, obviously, but I cannot think of that many more. There was a Master Builder. Who wrote that? Was that Chekhov?
Chekhov or Ibsen? Chekhov, probably. Yeah. I don't know, one of those. I've never read it or seen it. No.
I think I've seen it a long, long time ago, but I wouldn't be able to talk about that one because I don't know how it. Well, I don't know how it ends. Don't know how it starts.
You must have seen Our Feeder's Own Pet.
No, I never watched that. Actually,
never watched it.
No. Never watched
Boys
it. I don't know why.
Stuff?
Well, for an awful... Boys from the Black Stuff. Now, I did watch that. That actually, Boys from the Black Stuff inspired me to write a television play, which I never finished because I didn't know how to finish it. But that was back in the... That was in the 1983, 84, that was.
You didn't think of the Terry Gilliam ending? Just have a great big foot come down.
Oh, yes. No, Boys from the Black Stuff was great. During one of my periods of unemployment up in Stoke-on-Trent. Our Feeder's Own Pet? No, never watched it. Don't know why. For a long time, I didn't have a television, actually. I didn't watch any television.
We're talking about episodes we haven't done, so we better not go down there. Otherwise, someone might suggest we have to do a 201st episode. But it's not happening, people.
No, it's not.
Can I just conclude with two thank yous? One is to you, who's been listening to us. We've very grateful that you've been listening to us. Not enough of you out there, but we're grateful to you. And secondly, I think whenever I've mentioned him in the past, he edits himself out. So I hope he doesn't this time. But our producer, Tom Anderson, who's been in the background, keeping us on the straight and narrow, bleeping and cutting out all inappropriate things, well, most inappropriate things that we've put our foot in it, of Sound Rebel, the production company, podcast production company, Sound Rebel. Tom Anderson has been our life support system, and we are very grateful, and
we are indeed.
Can't recommend Sound Rebel highly enough to anyone who's thinking about starting a podcast of their own.
Yeah. Tom, it's been great, absolutely fantastic, and you've been very long suffering, and very professional, of course, as we'd expect. But no, it's been wonderful working with you.
And on that note,
I think we better bow out, Phil.
Once again, but never to be repeated, you've been listening to Reconstruction. I've been Phil Bishop, and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.